From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming your way on today's program, the official death toll in the wake of the earthquake in Nepal passes 6,000. There is another toll being addressed, the damage to Nepal's historic sites. We will talk with the director of the UNESCO office in Kathmandu. And an appeal for calm seems to be heated in the U.S. city of Baltimore. It is all ahead. Good day to you. I'm Ira Melman. The death toll from the earthquake in Nepal continues to rise, surpassing 6,200 people Friday. That number is expected to escalate yet even further as teams of rescue workers from across the world uncover bodies buried under the rubble of last Saturday's earthquake. Nepal's government is giving $1,000 to the families of the dead, plus $400 for burial costs. In Kathmandu, the capital, the overwhelming smell of dead bodies has become a main reason for making it nearly impossible for many residents who have been sleeping in the open since Saturday to return to their homes. United Nations says more than 8 million people were affected by the earthquake. At least 2 million have been displaced. In the capital Thursday, rescue workers pulled out two survivors from the rubble, rare moments of joy in the grisly recovery process.
Crowds cheered Thursday as a teenage boy was pulled alive from the wreckage of a seven-floor building in the capital, Kathmandu. Apart from being shocked by the experience, doctors say the boy is well.
First, I was eating my lunch with my friend, and there was an earthquake, and I started going downstairs. As I walked, all the walls started to crack, and the ceiling fell in.
A Nepalese policeman located the boy after hearing a response to his calls.
First of all, I knocked there, but no response. After calling many times, the boy responded. The young responded to me in my words. Then I confirmed there is a live victim. And then after, I started my rescue operation there.
It took Nepalese rescuers with support from an American disaster response team about 5 hours to free the trapped teenager.
It's what we call an entombment. So he wasn't specifically crushed, but what he was inside of a box with heavy concrete all around him. So the USAID teams, what we did is we worked side by side with the local teams, and we were there to assist them in getting this victim out.
A group of mountaineers got airlifted to safety Thursday after being stranded in a mountain village for 5 days.
We were just above Namche Bazaar going up to Everest View Hotel, and the entire mountain just kind of danced below our feet. And we saw two houses cave in front of us. They were made of stone. And we went to the village and we felt the aftershock also there, and people were just in a lot of chaos.
Foreign aid continues to pour into Nepal, delivering emergency supplies and personnel, including medical teams.
I'm looking forward to providing help. I think I'm well prepared. On the other hand, the situation is still not stable on site. There's still a danger of aftershocks. We heard it yesterday again. And then there is the smell of corpses in some areas, which is not too comfortable. So I must say, I have some mixed feelings.
Da hat man dann schon etwas gemischte Gefühle.
Humanitarian aid finally reached some places near the quake's epicenter. Hundreds of Nepalese people have walked for miles from remote and inaccessible areas to this village to find food and shelter.
Everything is difficult. Getting food and water is difficult. Oil, salt is difficult. My house is destroyed. I have nothing. It is very hard.
Two-thirds of Nepal's population of 27 million are farmers. Much of their seed stocks have been lost in the quake, signaling bleak prospects for this year's sowing season. Slaritza Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
We welcome Christian Manhart. He heads the UNESCO office in Kathmandu in Nepal. Christian, thank you so much for being with us. Obviously, this is a very difficult task that you are undertaking here. Can you just overall just give us the scope of what the problems are in the wake of this earthquake?
Yeah, it's really, really dramatic. First of all, the loss of life, of course, but then also the loss of cultural heritage. And it is when we go through the streets of Kathmandu, it's a total drama what we see. in the Kathmandu Valley, there are 7 World Heritage Sites, and 3 of them are very, very heavily destroyed. The most destroyed is the Kathmandu Durbar Square, where part of the Royal Palace collapsed and most of the temples collapsed. And then Bhaktapur, which is a city a little bit outside of the of Kathmandu, also is heavily damaged. There are most of the temples which collapsed and many private houses as well. Most of these old historic houses in the big old town of Bhaktapur, houses which have been restored and temples which have been restored during the last 40 years, all fell down. And then the Pathan Durbar Square, the Royal Palace, is still standing. Only one tower of it leaning, so this will require some emergency consolidation very soon. And half of the temples totally collapsed, so they are just rubble now.
Are any of these sites salvageable?
Of course, now at this stage, rather difficult to say, but I have some hope that restoration can be really successful, because we have in the rubble, we have all the architectural features. So what cracked down is mainly the brick walls, and the statues and the wooden beams, which are very beautifully carved in most of these temples, and or lintels or cornerstones, all them are there. So they are almost not destroyed, as far as I saw, from many temples, and they are just now inside the rubble, and they have to be safeguarded. What we started already, and what is also a positive aspect for future restoration is that most of these sites are very, very well documented. So we have detailed photographs, we have architectural drawings, we have measurements, in particular for the World Heritage sites. All this is available, and we can use this for future reconstruction. But not only World Heritage sites, actually, it's also the private houses in Bhaktapur and the temples outside of the World Heritage perimeter, also where since the 1970s, documented by architects and engineers.
How long might it take to restore the World Heritage sites, and how much money would that cost, and where would that money come from?
Yeah, that's a difficult question, which we are asking ourselves as well. I think that the restoration only of the World Heritage sites will take at least 10 years, maybe much more. For the funding, we have not yet figures for this, so we are now just at the first evaluation. Our evaluation now is just assessment of damage, very roughly, and also prioritizing those monuments which are still standing and which need immediate consolidation in order to prevent their collapse. And I told all the engineers and architects which are now out to do this work to also immediately put figures on it, to say how much this would cost, how much would cost now at the first stage the emergency consolidation, and we would make detailed projects more in a next phase where we will do exact plans how to restore each monument, and there also we will then provide figures. And where the money will come from, it's sure that the government of Nepal has not enough money for this, and also UNESCO has not enough money, because the task is just enormous, and we very much rely on the generosity of and the help of other countries. And we got already a lot of pledges. For example, a woman from Hong Kong donated $250,000 for emergency consolidation, and we also got $75,000 from the World Heritage Fund. And this, of course, is not enough for the restoration, but it helps us now to ensure the coordination of all the teams and emergency consolidation and doing the assessment of the damage.
On a personal level, what runs through your mind? What are your emotions as you drive around looking at the damage?
Actually, I do not drive around because it's difficult to drive with a car around. I go by bicycle at the moment, which is the best means of transportation. And it is, for me, it is still not real, you know. When I look at this, I still have not totally realized that this Nepal, which was a little paradise when I arrived here 7 months ago, does not exist in this form anymore. So it's very, very hard, and it is very emotional, and even more for the Nepali. You know, many Nepali, when I speak with them about the heritage, they have the tears in their eyes.
You have any idea monetarily how much it might cost to do the job you feel you must do?
The job to finish the restoration.
Yes.
I don't know. It will be tens of millions of dollars, or I have no idea at the moment. Really, it's very difficult to say, but it will be a huge amount for sure.
Kristen, I thank you so much for your time and your information. Good luck to you, and hopefully we'll be able to speak again. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
That is Christian. Christian Manhart, the man who heads the UNESCO office in Kathmandu in Nepal. Now, meanwhile, the UN did launch an urgent appeal Wednesday for $415 million to provide shelter for 500,000 people who were sleeping out in the open, as well as medicine, water, and food for millions affected by the quake. The UN said these disaster destroyed 130,000 homes, damaged thousands more. In addition, the UN Food and Agricultural Organization said $8 million is urgently needed to help the Nepalese farmers recover their losses and assist them with the imminent rice-growing season. Now, on Wednesday, U.S. President Barack Obama discussed aid efforts in a telephone call with Nepal's prime minister. The U.S. is providing more than $10 million for both immediate efforts, such as clean water and search and rescue operations, and for long-term recovery efforts. People in Kathmandu continued leaving Thursday by bus to reach their families in remote areas that were hardest hit by the magnitude 7.8 quake. Many in Nepal have been frustrated by what they say is a slow response by the government. Several hundred people protested Wednesday by blocking traffic in Kathmandu. From Washington, this is International Edition from the Voice of America. The sudden cancellation of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's visit to Moscow has set off a new round of speculation on just what's happening inside the secretive regime. VOA's Brian Padden reports from Seoul on the effort to understand a high-profile change of plans for the leader, who analysts believe hasn't left the country since taking control in late 2011.
Why the supreme leader of North Korea suddenly canceled a planned visit to Moscow next week to commemorate the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II in Europe is a mystery. No explanations have been forthcoming either from authorities in Pyongyang nor from the official state news agency. Russian officials said the decision was linked to internal Korean affairs. Kim Young-hyun, a North Korean studies professor at Dongguk University, thinks Kim Jong-un did not want to offend his economic benefactors in China by making his first international trip to Russia. He says it seems like the North Korean leader decided not to visit Russia because he might feel uncomfortable if he encounters President Xi Jinping in Moscow. China, through aid and trade, is North Korea's chief food and energy supplier. So it makes sense that the young leader would want to make Beijing the destination of his first international trip. However, there are signs of tensions. This week, China said it is investigating the killing of three villagers in a border town where North Korean guards have been accused of crossing over to commit thefts and assaults. There have also been signs of growing concern on the part of Chinese officials over the size of North Korea's nuclear arsenal. Last month, Chinese nuclear experts told U.S. officials that Pyongyang may already have 20 warheads, more than the 10 to 16 bombs U.S. experts had estimated. Beijing also believes Pyongyang has the capability to double its arsenal by next year. This week, South Korea's spy agency said it believes Kim Jong-un has ordered executions of 15 senior officials seen as disloyal. This has led to speculation about instability in the ruling elite. North Korea analyst Daniel Pinkston with the International Crisis Group discounts theories that recent events indicate instability in the regime or any sign that Kim Jong-un is losing his grip on power. Pinkston says the last-minute cancellation is not uncommon, given how North Korean security protocols work.
Having spoken to people who've met Kim Jong-un, that, of course, the security protocols are very tight in how they operated in North Korea. The Guard Command, which is responsible for his security, they only confirm things at the last moment.
He and a number of other analysts speculated that negotiations with Russia broke down either over protocol or due to demands one side was trying to impose on the other. North Korea has a history of trying to extract concessions before agreeing to engage in international dialogue about limiting its nuclear program. Former South Korean President Lee Myung-bak recently revealed that in 2009, Kim Jong-il demanded $10 billion in cash and 500,000 tons of food as a precondition of holding a summit with the South. These analysts say it is very possible that Pyongyang walked away after Moscow refused to provide significant foreign investment or military technologies. Or it may have been the other way around. Maybe it was Russia that asked too much of North Korea to make some concession to restart international talks about its nuclear program or refrain from future missile tests. Another possible scenario is that Kim Jong-un canceled after he realized he would not play a prominent role in the Moscow commemoration. There may have been concerns that the television coverage beamed back to North Korea would undercut the cultivated image of the supreme leader as an almost divine figure. Because of the North's tight control over information, Pinkston says much of the analysis made about the inner workings of the government in Pyongyang is more than guesswork, but less than confirmed reporting.
Yes, I think so. Sometimes you have to go forward with some underlying assumptions and understanding of how authoritarian politics operate. And the experience in North Korea, the legacy of the Kim family regime and the institutional setting and all of that.
Pinkston says it is important not to read too much into one event or decision, especially as the dynamics of power on the Korean peninsula have remained stable over time despite occasional flare-ups. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
This is International Edition from the Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Authorities in the nearby U.S. city of Baltimore, near to us anyway, are appealing for calm and patience as prosecutors decide whether to charge officers involved in the arrest of a young black man who died in police custody. Police turned over the findings of their own report on the death of to the state's attorney's office Thursday, a whole day ahead of a self-imposed deadline. The conclusions of that internal investigation have not been made public. Now, this police secrecy surrounding the case has added to the frustration of many who are complaining that authorities have not been forthcoming about the death of 25-year-old Freddie Gray, who died of a spinal injury on the 19th of April. State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby said Thursday her office is conducting its own probe into the death. Protesters Thursday held another large, peaceful demonstration in downtown Baltimore, but the streets largely emptied following a 10 p.m. curfew that authorities say will most likely last for another few days. City has generally been calm since the riots broke out late Monday, but authorities, including the National Guard, which has been deployed in the city, are braced for more unrest if details of the police investigation do leak out. These details remain hazy surrounding Gray's death. He was arrested April 12th after making eye contact with police and engaging in a short foot chase with them. Several media outlets have reported that Gray may have been injured while riding in the police transport van after being arrested, citing a police document. The Washington Post said another prisoner riding in a separate section of the van could hear Gray banging it against the walls and believed he was intentionally trying to injure himself. The suggestion that Gray, whose spine was sent by lawyers to be severed 80% at the neck, may have hurt himself has enraged members of Gray's family and protesters on the street. The Baltimore Police Commissioner, told Thursday, called on a public to take a deep breath and wait for the entire information, adding that hopefully these leaks will not poison what is happening. Saudi Arabia says it has killed dozens of Yemeni Shiite rebels who were carrying out a large-scale cross-border attack in the kingdom. In a statement, Riyadh's defense ministry said three Saudi soldiers were killed in the late Thursday fighting in South Najran province. The ministry says the rebels attacked border posts and control points. They were repelled by a combination of Saudi ground troops and airstrikes. It's believed to be the largest cross-border attack by the rebels since a Saudi-led coalition began a campaign of airstrikes against them 5 weeks ago. Riyadh did say last week that it was scaling back the air raid, saying it has accomplished its goal of weakening the rebels, which are believed to be backed by Iran. The Houthis are loyal to former longtime President Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was ousted in 2012 during the so-called Arab Spring protests that swept the region. The rebels have overtaken the Yemeni capital of Sana'a and forced the country's western-backed leader, Abdu Rabu Mansour Hadi, to flee to Saudi Arabia. There's a new poll out that says that nearly three-quarters of Americans say it is acceptable for the United States to use an unarmed aerial drone to kill an American citizen abroad if that person has joined a terror organization. That, according to a new Associated Press GFK poll, the majority, 6 in 10, supports the use of drones to target territories and terrorists in general. Only 13% oppose the use, and another 24% don't feel strongly either way. Now, thanks for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day. Just check our website at voanews.com. I'm Ira Melman in Washington.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
On the night of September 11th, 2012, members of the Ansar al-Sharia terrorist group attacked two U.S. government facilities in Benghazi, Libya. Using machine guns, rocket-propelled grenades, and mortars, the militants targeted the U.S. Special Mission compound and a nearby annex in repeated assaults, killing four Americans, including the U.S. ambassador, wounding two more U.S. personnel, and three Libyan contract guards. Both facilities were destroyed. Rewards were offered, and an intensive search mounted for those responsible for the attack. On June 15th, U.S. military personnel arrested a key suspect in the operation, Ahmed Abu Katala, a senior leader of Ansar al-Sharia in Benghazi, has been charged with murder and other charges, and will be sent to the United States to stand trial. Others involved in the attack remain at large, and the United States will do whatever it takes to see that justice is done. Created after the fall of Libya's longtime ruler, Muammar Gaddafi, Ansar al-Sharia has been involved in many attacks in the region, targeting civilians and assassinating or attempting to assassinate security officials and political actors in eastern Libya. Its members continue to pose a threat to U.S. interests in Libya and have been designated as international terrorist organizations. Toward this end, the Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $10 million for information leading to the arrest or conviction of any individual responsible for the Benghazi attacks. The U.S. guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these individuals, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy or the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.